The opinions expressed on the following program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Hello, everyone. This is Tracy welcoming you to Everyday Health, an Audio Journal program in which we share information about healthy living. This broadcast is for informational purposes only, and suggestions should always be discussed with your healthcare providers. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. In this age of access to so much information, in this broadcast, we're going to take a look at some of the many medical and lifestyle suggestions that tend to trend on the internet. An article written by Jessica Megala will explore 5 medical myths and how accurate or not they are. Following that, we will review a very legitimate health hack, meditation. In Lauren Metchling's article, we'll provide 5 different meditations for people who just can't meditate. And as we often do, we'll conclude with today's tip. So to begin, at some point, most of us have typed our symptoms into Dr. Google against our better judgment. Now, Dr. TikTok, Dr. Instagram, and Dr. YouTube have entered the chat, with creators making claims about nutrition, hormones, immunity, and so much more. Some are licensed medical professionals, and some are, quote-unquote, wellness experts, who want to teach us all about our toxins by putting raw potatoes in our socks. There has been a rise in health and science influencers, no question. Many have good intentions, and others do not, says Dr. Jessica Steyer, a doctor of public health and the founder of the Unbiased Science podcast, which one can listen to at unbiasedscipod, which critically examines the evidence for various health claims. These experts may proffer misinformation that's at best a waste of time and potatoes, and at worst, harmful. Other health creators and even some doctors are only interested in selling you products to help suss out suspect information. This article asked legitimate members of medical social media to debunk 5 of those most viral myths. The first one, certain healthy foods are not actually healthy. The debunker for this question is Nicole Rodriguez, who is a registered dietitian, nutritionist, and a certified personal trainer. Now, what's not to love about good old oatmeal? It's nutritious and filling. It's a go-to for many health-conscious eaters. But on social media, the beloved breakfast has its share of haters, mainly the type of low-carb living evangelists who label plant-based foods as poisonous. They insist oatmeal raises your blood sugar so high, well, you might as well just eat a candy bar. Oatmeal does increase blood sugar, but that is our body's normal response to any carb-containing food, Rodriguez explains. The real story is that most Americans need more whole grains and fiber. Almost all U.S. adults, 95% of us actually, skimp on fiber. And we need it because it's linked to improved heart health and digestion. A 1-cup serving of cooked oats packs 4 grams. That's about 15% of your daily requirement. And if blood sugar is a concern, you can combine the oats with protein, like a poached egg or egg whites, and a plant-based fat, like avocado, to help your body digest the meal more slowly. And have you heard the hubbub about seed oils? Canola, corn, sunflower, and peanut, just to name a few? Well, they've been maligned online for supposedly causing heart attacks, diabetes, and other issues. But the data was misinterpreted, according to Rodriguez. Yes, health problems have risen in conjunction with our higher intake of seed oils. The culprit, though, is the products that often contain the oils, fast food, packaged snacks, and baked goods, which tend to be highly processed and have loads of saturated fat, sodium, and calories. the oils themselves are not harmful. In fact, they can be very rich in omega-6s, unsaturated fatty acids our bodies actually need to function properly. So if you love to cook with canola oil, go ahead, although Rodriguez does recommend olive oil, which benefits heart and brain health. Finally, there's smoothies. Well, they're criticized constantly for their high sugar content, but when they're made correctly, they can be a nutritious, fiber-filled package. So drink up, because once again, the more pressing problem is that you probably need more produce in your diet. We are actually in a real fruit and vegetable consumption crisis, Rodriguez says. Just 10% of adults get enough produce per day, according to the CDC. And guess what's an amazing vehicle for fruits and vegetables? Yes, the answer to that is smoothies. Add a source of protein, such as milk, yogurt, or protein powder, and healthy fats, like avocado and nut butter, Rodriguez advises. Do that, and you'll have a great portable meal. The next myth is that you can boost your immune system to better fight off illness. The debunker in this case is Dr. Andrea Love, a microbiologist, immunologist, and founder of the science and health communication organization, Immunologic. If you'd like to help your immune system, stay current on your vaccines, and don't worry about the turmeric cocktails, frozen carrot and ginger immunity cubes, or salt baths for your feet. The immune system is an incredibly complex, very tightly regulated network. White blood cells constantly patrol your body, looking for invaders to fight off. These cells work with certain organs like your spleen, which produces antibodies, your tissues, like your bone marrow, which produce blood cells, and the lymphatic system, which carries away destroyed bacteria and other waste products. Love says that strengthening such an intricate system of interdependent parts is not just a matter of ratcheting it up. You can't flex the immune system like a muscle, which is what some unsubstantiated claims do suggest. And even if you could, pumping up your immune system would not necessarily be a good thing. Too much strength in your immune system is a hallmark of inflammatory disorders, like allergies and autoimmune diseases, in which your body attacks substances that it should not. What you can do is support your immune system with, surprise, you've heard it here many times, healthy habits. Get enough sleep. Exercise regularly. Eat a well-balanced diet. Limit alcohol. Avoid tobacco. And practice good hygiene. Hopefully you're doing all those things anyway. The next myth, your digestive, skin, mood, woes are definitely a food sensitivity issue. The debunker in this case is Dr. David Stukas, a pediatric allergist and director of the Food Allergy Center at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. Maybe you've seen an influencer claim that they discovered a sensitivity to certain foods, lima beans, kiwi fruit, brewer's yeast, and once they eliminated it, their troubling symptoms just disappeared. Well, no matter how alluring you find the idea of a quick fix, hold off on ordering that pricey do-it-yourself testing kit. The term food sensitivity is so vague, it's almost meaningless. Have a food allergy means that your body mounts an immune reaction when you encounter a specific protein, in cow's milk, eggs, fish, or etc. Having a food sensitivity just means you don't digest that food especially well. It's actually a made-up term with no clear diagnostic criteria or consensus definition by experts, Dr. Stukas says. Allergies can be detected by skin prick testing, in which a very small amount of allergens are placed under the skin's surface to see if a reaction takes place. But there are no validated ways to detect sensitivities. If you order one of the at-home tests heavily promoted on social media, it will probably just measure something called IG, capital G, an antibody that's part of a normal immune response to any eating. The results can show only that you've eaten the food recently, not whether it's problematic for you. Avoiding foods based on the results of these tests can lead to an unnecessarily restrictive diet, nutritional deficiencies, and disordered eating, Dr. Stukas says. Plus, influencers peddling the tests may use them as bait to enroll followers in long-term programs that call for more testing and a lot more money. If you have serious concerns about your gastrointestinal tract, see your primary care provider who can help diagnose you or refer you to a specialist. Next, the myth is everyone has ADHD. The debunker here is Dr. Sanam Hafiz, a neuropsychologist and founder of the Comprehensive Consultation Psychological Services in New York City. Social media has encouraged open conversations about many mental health issues, which is definitely a positive thing. And connecting with others who share your struggle can be extremely validating. The flip side is that quick video clips can oversimplify very complicated issues, as is frequently the case with ADHD, known as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Once seen as a condition primarily affecting fidgeting boys, it's now recognized in more adults and women. An estimate from the health data firm Epic Research says that percentage of young and middle-aged women newly diagnosed with the disorder nearly doubled from 2020 to 2022. Countless posts highlight the hidden symptoms that might indicate ADHD. Constantly bumping into things, chronically running late, leaving cabinet doors open, daydreaming, and being messy. Well, it's tempting to self-diagnose based on a cluster of symptoms seen in a TikTok video, Dr. Hafiz says, because we have a natural urge to understand ourselves and find explanations for our challenges, and that can be a great relief. Furthermore, once we're convinced that we've discovered the explanation, we may fall prey to something called confirmation bias, which is the tendency to pay attention to evidence that supports our theory and disregard anything that does not. If you're concerned, seek a full assessment by a trained clinician, such as a neuropsychologist, a psychiatrist, a neurologist, or a psychologist. Standardized neuropsychological testing is used to diagnose mental conditions, and that process can take several months. Often clinicians discover that even if you do have ADHD, there may be other things going on, a learning or reading disability, depression, anxiety, or another mental health condition. So it's really in your very best interest to see an expert. The last myth today is your hormones need to be balanced, especially if you're in perimenopause. The debunker here is Dr. Asima Ahmad, an OBGYN, reproductive endocrinology and infertility specialist and chief medical officer of the fertility platform Carrot. The videos tend to follow a pattern. If you're experiencing, insert long list of symptoms here, insomnia, mood swings, fatigue, etc., your hormones are imbalanced, and hormones may indeed be involved in what's ailing you. Dr. Ahmad says, in some way, shape, or form, hormones affect every part of our bodies, including energy and mood. So it's not uncommon to have them evaluated as part of a workup if you're having unexplained symptoms. But since hormones can fluctuate throughout a person's life, hormone imbalance is an extremely broad term. Still, some so-called women's health experts will try to sell you an at-home hormone test or get you to take a hormone panel, then encourage you to buy supplements or begin therapy with compounded bioidentical, i.e. artificial, hormones, which are not FDA approved or recommended by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. If someone is telling you to check your hormones and then selling you a quick fix product that's profitable for them, please be very wary, especially if they are not a board certified physician, Dr. Ahmad warns. Discuss your symptoms with your primary care doctor or OBGYN, who may refer you to a general or reproductive endocrinologist. If your concern specifically involves perimenopause or menopause, visit the North American Menopause Society site to search for a certified practitioner. So how to spot social media quacks? Well, influencers have gotten really, really good. They cite studies and they quote doctors, which makes it challenging to decide who to trust. Here are telltale signs you may be getting beginning misinformation. Absolute statements are used. Researchers cannot ever 100% guarantee that X, Y, or Z is causing or preventing anything, Dr. Steyer says. Science, of course, is an ongoing process, and as new evidence emerges, understandings evolve. The research contradicts scientific consensus. Watch out for people who present themselves as brave mavericks going against the grain. You can always, always find a study to support any particular claim, Dr. Steyer says. But what does overall research show? Beware of health coaches pontificating about hormones or nutrition experts who are not registered dietitians. If they're stepping outside their expertise, take what they say with a grain of salt, Dr. Steyer suggests. And especially be aware if a post or something you listen to is meant to push a product. They may be biased, Steyer warns. This does not necessarily mean they're sketchy. It just means you should look deeper into their claims and the subject matter expertise before you hit that buy button. And now for a very legitimate health hack, meditation. As you and probably the rest of the world have heard, it's as beneficial as physical exercise. Meditation can improve sleep, reduce anxiety, and even help with chronic pain. Though the author says, I am intimately familiar with stress and insomnia, and a recent tumble off a bike added pain to the mix. She writes, I avoided mindfulness, telling myself that only the deeply woo-woo put those poof pillows to use. She writes, I managed my stress by jogging to the bad boy anthems of Machine Gun Kelly. And then I learned that even Machine Gun Kelly meditates every morning, and I knew it was time to reassess. So, according to a Harvard University study, the average person's mind wanders at least, now hear this, 47% of time awake, and a wandering mind is an unhappier one. Thankfully, there are innumerable ways to tap into meditation's calming, head-clearing powers. It doesn't have to happen on a cushion, says Jamie Price, a co-founder of the mindfulness app My Life. Some of the most rewarding experiences can come from things like walking or even really savoring a meal. Here are techniques from the simple to the slightly more esoteric, none of them requiring a lifetime commitment. But be warned, they just might change your life. Overachiever cooks who say an hour of stirring risotto is meditative, well, believe it or not, they're onto something. The Zen Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh says washing the dishes is like bathing a baby Buddha. While you're at the stove, focus on your breathing or the scent of whatever you're cooking. Any activity can be meditative when you bring your full awareness to your five senses, Price says. And of course, mindfulness apps offer a slew of options, calming soundscapes and guided meditations. And some apps actually team up with streaming services so you can tune in while you're, you know, tuning in. Headspace co-founder Andy Puddicombe is a circus-trained former Tibetan Buddhist monk who leads many of his guided meditations. He's very good to listen to. And if you're fidgety, well, that's okay. Moving meditations like walking can deepen your focus and your sense of peace. A recent study showed that older adults who went on weekly walks in which they shifted attention outward to sound and smell, striving to enjoy familiar objects in fresh ways, felt more upbeat than their non-walking counterparts. Go outside for a 5-minute stroll or stand and concentrate on what you can smell and what you can hear. When your mind wanders, simply bring it back. You can also check out 30 to 60 minute silent walk meditations available for free at mindtravel.com. And if the idea of inhabiting the present moment is too overwhelming, try loving kindness meditations. It's a form of mindfulness that involves mentally sending good wishes to the people around you, from your closest loved ones to strangers on the street. Well, does that sound corny? Well, German neuroscientist Tania Singer research shows that compassion, as demonstrated in loving kindness, produces positive effects in our brains. It helps strengthen a sense of interconnectedness, explains Leslie Desaulniers, a yoga and meditation teacher in California. She recommends sitting for 10 minutes, focusing on yourself, or if that's too hard, and it generally is for many people, focus on someone from your life, a family member or person you often see at the grocery store. May you be safe, may you be happy, may you be free. If there's someone you struggle to feel compassion for, try envisioning them as a baby. Desaulniers suggests picture their little face and see how they need someone to hold them too. She writes that she tried this technique on a challenging person, and she said, I saw her little cheeks and vulnerability that I'm not used to associating with her. The next time I spoke with her, I was happy to do so. And here's the one that's sort of transcendental. Transcendental meditation, whose celebrity devotees include everyone from Jerry Seinfeld to Katy Perry, entails repeating a personalized mantra. Diehards commit to 2 20-minute sessions per day. However, teacher Tony Lupinacci, who practices a mantra meditation called Vedic meditation, says you can start with just 5 minutes. Consistency, as in most things, is what's most important. He recommends focusing on the sound shreem or om, which comes from Sanskrit. Mantras are not supposed to be attached to any meaning, but a little research told me, says the author, that shreem is associated with Lakshmi, the Hindu goddess of good fortune and wealth. And as she writes, who are we to turn away Lakshmi's treasures? Find a quiet corner and chant, if you can, even for 5 minutes, and see what happens. Try any of these techniques and get good vibrations indeed. Once again, you can check out mindtravel.com, Headspace, and any other app. I also suggest Insight Timer for many, many, many free meditations to consider at all different time lengths. And for today's tip, you may not know that September has been designated as National Suicide Prevention Month. If you or anyone you know is struggling with suicidality, please call the national number of 988. It's available 24/7 for anyone who is interested in getting any kind of support for mental wellness. Also, you can check out mass.gov/suicide. On it is extensive information about where to get help and find local resources. Remember, by making small adjustments and embracing healthy habits, you can lead a fulfilling and health-conscious life. Thank you so much for joining us today for Everyday Health. As you know, our broadcast is for informational purposes only, and suggestions should always be discussed with your healthcare providers. Our program is a production of Audio Journal, and we are a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you'd like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call us at 508-797-1117, and do so if you have suggestions or an interest you'd like us to review for programming. Archived editions are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. And know this, we wish you health every day.
And now, medical myths and facts with Dr. Richard Curtis.
When the Black Death arrived in Europe in 1347, physicians had no knowledge of bacteria, fleas, or antibiotics. When COVID-19 appeared in 2019, we possessed germ theory, laboratories, and clinical trials. But initially, we still faced the frightening question our ancestors had faced. What can we do before we know what works? The comparison is revealing. During the Black Death, one treatment was bloodletting. Medieval physicians believed plague resulted from an imbalance of the body's 4 humors. Removing blood was supposed to remove the illness, but it probably weakened already dehydrated patients. During COVID, the comparable error was not bloodletting, but using treatments because they seemed biologically plausible. Hydroxychloroquine, an anti-malarial drug, inhibited the coronavirus in laboratory experiments and was rapidly adopted in some hospitals. Large randomized trials subsequently showed that it did not prevent death or improve the condition of hospitalized patients, and its use was abandoned. A second plague treatment involved opening the buboes and applying onions, herbs, or even the plucked rear end of a chicken to draw out the poison. COVID produced its own attempts to extract or destroy the virus. People inhaled hydrogen peroxide, drank hazardous chemicals, or used veterinary preparations. Following public discussion about disinfectants, poison control centers received calls concerning ingestion or injection. These were never legitimate medical treatments, but they illustrate how far fear can turn a misunderstood scientific idea into dangerous self-treatment. Third, wealthy plague victims purchased Theriac, an expensive mixture containing dozens of ingredients, sometimes including opium and viper flesh. It had a long history and impressive reputation, but no evidence that it cured plague. The COVID parallel was ivermectin. Unlike Theriac, ivermectin is a genuinely valuable drug for parasitic diseases. Preliminary laboratory findings and small, often unreliable studies created enormous enthusiasm. Better randomized studies ultimately found no meaningful benefit against COVID. Its popularity demonstrated that an established medicine can acquire a second reputation that outruns the evidence. Fourth, medieval people tried to cleanse the bad air. They carried flowers, burned incense, and fumigated houses. The theory was wrong, but it contained an accidental insight. Air was involved. Pneumonic plague can spread through respiratory droplets. COVID also forced science to revise its understanding of the air. Early advice emphasized disinfecting groceries and surfaces. Gradually, evidence showed that SARS-CoV-2 spread predominantly through airborne particles, especially indoors. Ventilation, filtration, and well-fitting masks became more important than scrubbing every package. Here, recommendations changed, not because science had failed, but because science was working. Fifth, both pandemics produce remedies based upon human blood. Medieval medicine removed supposedly corrupted blood. During COVID, physicians gave convalescent plasma collected from recovered patients, hoping its antibodies would neutralize the virus. The idea was scientifically reasonable, and plasma may have helped selected immunocompromised patients when given early. Yet large trials found no general survival benefit for most hospitalized patients. There was, however, a crucial difference between the two eras. Medieval treatments persisted because there was no reliable system for comparing them. During COVID, enormous randomized trials could test several therapies simultaneously. The recovery trial established within months that the inexpensive steroid dexamethasone reduced deaths in severely ill patients requiring oxygen, while showing that hydroxychloroquine was ineffective. Other research led to effective antiviral drugs, including Paxlovid, for high-risk outpatients and highly effective vaccines. Both pandemics reveal the same human pattern. Fear creates an urgent demand to do something, anything. Anecdotes become evidence, prominent endorsements replace careful testing, and treatments become attached to political or religious identity. But COVID also demonstrates the progress made since the Black Death. Science does not promise instant certainty. Its strength is that it can test its own ideas, admit mistakes, and replace desperate hope with treatments shown to save lives.